You're listening to the River East Church Podcast, a Jesus community for the world.
So, I was excited when I started chatting with Gerald. This is quite some time ago, and found out that he was a clinical psychologist. And at that point, I planted a seed in his mind and said, would you consider speaking at cross-training? And why that question? Well, you've probably noticed that we have, in the last month or two, and maybe even before that, quite a few newcomers here at River East. What you might not notice, if you are a newcomer, or even if you've been here a long time, is I can identify at least three separate groups of newcomers. And if this, if you don't know that, you just assume that everybody else has been here a long time, but that isn't the case. In the last several months, maybe more than that, I've identified a group of people from around the neighborhood or in our spheres of influence. People are inviting friends to church, or people live in the neighborhood and they've said, hey, there's a church, I want to check it out. So that's one group of people who are here, and that's wonderful. And another group of people who have started coming. Last December and January, we had some public meetings that talked about our journey to inclusivity and our talking points from the Bible about why we are becoming an inclusive church. And it's been about a year or so, but in the last little while, a number of people who are really seeking to bring the Bible and inclusion together have started coming to the church. And then there's a third group. Stuff has been happening at Douglas Mennonite, and a number of people from Douglas Mennonite have been coming. So there are three different groups. And what I know about church life is every time we have new people come, we this body of River East Church changes a little bit. And so we are experiencing change, and we being the collective group of all these wonderful new people who are coming are experiencing, like, what does it mean to consider River East Church as our home? What does belonging look like? There's probably lots of questions. And this topic of what does it mean to belong? People have been studying that in various ways for a long time. And Gerald Loewen has been studying and practicing and experiencing and counseling people with attachment, using the lens of attachment theory. And so he will speak to us today about attachment theory. And cross-training is looking at various lenses to examine what does it mean to belong. And so today, attachment theory. Thank you, Gerald. And a little bit about Gerald. He told me that he was born in Steinbach, and his family attended the Steinbach Mennonite Brethren Church. During elementary years, you went to Elmwood Church, and then your family moved back to Steinbach, and you went there. Your mom is still a member at Steinbach MB Church. In the early 80s, you studied psychology at U of W, and were good friends. Jan told me that you were good friends back there. Then off to Minneapolis, where you've practiced for 30 years, I think. And more than that, you can tell us yourself. Come speak to us.
So I want to start off by taking advantage of being a, what I'll call a Mennonite microphone, and say something about how amazing and inspiring it was to watch Jimmy Carter's funeral on Thursday, which I did with my mother. We watched Rosalind's a year ago. And I got an email from a friend this last week who is a part of the Fort Garry Mennonite Fellowship, where Jimmy and Rosalind once worshiped in 1993. And I gather last Sunday at this time, probably, some people reported or was read a firsthand account of that Sunday morning. And I just wanted to share one part of it, if I find it on my notes. And that is that Jimmy Carter said that if he was not a Southern Baptist, he would choose to be a Mennonite. The only thing I'll add to Marianne's lovely introduction is that the reason our family moved to Winnipeg for my elementary school years, my father, Bob Lowen, was the proprietor of Lowen Funeral Chapel, and I'm wearing the tie he wore to conduct funerals. And then we moved back to Steinbeck when the partnership between him and his brother Ray, made famous in a movie, dissolved. And also, I wanted to say that my parents were close family friends with Jake and Catherine Clausen. And because the funeral of Mr. Clausen was between Christmas and New Year's, I got to come here with my mother and brother for that amazing event in this sanctuary. And I'll say more about my academic and professional history sort of as I go along. And I hope there's time for discussion. I'm a little nervous about that, or maybe a lot nervous. In preparation for today, I've made very good use of a book called Strange Situation, A Mother's Journey into the Science of Attachment, by Bethany Saltman, published in 2020, which has more about Mary Ainsworth than I have ever read or heard anywhere else. There is one copy of this in the Winnipeg Public Library. And I've never heard Mary Ainsworth discussed better than in this book. So any discussion of attachment theory must begin with John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. John Bowlby was born in 1907 and was trained as a psychoanalyst in England. Mary Ainsworth was born in 1913 in Ohio, and at the age of 5, she and her family moved to Toronto. She was a student of psychology at the University of Toronto by the time she was 16, where she took a job in the same clinic as where John Bowlby was practicing. This book has a lengthy quotation from Ainsworth about her development of the strange situation procedure. And at the very end, she says, "We devised it in half an hour." Knowing how critical this strange situation procedure, which I'll describe in a minute, has been to just a huge volume of empirical research in attachment, I was shocked. And then in the very next sentence, she quotes an Ainsworth student as saying, "It was an afterthought. The strange situation was an afterthought." So let's learn a little bit about the strange situation procedure. And if any of you are interested, there are excerpts of it on YouTube. Just put in strange situation procedure. It takes about 20 minutes. It involves usually the mother and a 12 to 18 month old infant. And it's a scenario of increasingly stressful events, especially for the baby. The mother leaves for a time, up to 3 minutes. A stranger comes into the room, and eventually the mother and the child are reunited, and it's the behavior that exhibited at reunion that determines that baby's attachment classification, of which there are three. Securely attached, those children after being distressed due to mother separation, the child's reunion with the mother restores the infant to a calm state. And the average globally of securely attached infants is about 65%. So that's good news, I think. And then there are two variations of insecure or anxious attachment. One is anxious avoidant. These babies may not have been particularly distressed when separated from mother. And when mother returns in the reunion, they often show little emotion. Anxious ambivalent are those infants who are likely to show distress when separated, but reunion fails to restore them to calm. The baby isn't so easily comforted by mother. And the next two sentences in my notes are in parentheses. There's a fourth category called disorganized category of anxious attachment. But because this was discovered after I went to graduate school, I don't really know very much about it. As the name disorganized suggests, the reunion between mother and child is rather chaotic. So an internal working model or inner working model is the phrase used to describe the collection of memories developed over time and experience by the child and is seen to reflect these differences. For the securely attached child, the internal working model might be something like, when I become distressed, I have learned to seek mother's comfort, and I know that mother will help me to calm down. For anxious avoidant children, I may not be so distressed by mother's absence to begin with, and whether or not I am distressed, I have learned that my mother is not available to help me calm down. And the anxious ambivalent, when I become distressed, I have learned that I don't know if mother is going to help me calm down. Sometimes she does, sometimes she doesn't. And a quick sidebar, which I'm not going to talk about anymore, is that one aspect of attachment work that has been very, very important is that one of Mary Ainsworth's students named Mary Main developed the adult attachment interview. And that's the instrument that's used to determine an adult's attachment classification. And her early research showed that the correlation between the parents' attachment classification and the infant's, as shown in a strange situation procedure 6 years earlier, was an incredible 75%. A finding in attachment research that's been replicated over and over again, and maybe one of the most important and robust findings in the research. And before moving to some specific examples, I want to describe some of the main ideas and key phrases in attachment theory. And as you hear me describe them, I'd ask you to think about how they are or are not in existence here at River East, whether you are somebody who has been at River East for a very long time, or like me, you're still very new here. And hopefully there'll be time for discussion later. So here are some main attachment terms and concepts. Secure base. This is probably the single most important one. Attachment theory holds that distress is incompatible with exploration, and securely attached babies are seen as experiencing their mothers as a secure base from which to go out to explore their environment and to which to return when needing support, love, and attention. We might use the word safety and describe this back and forth movement of the baby as a safety-seeking mechanism. Again, the most important thing is that we, in attachment theory, is that we need to be secure in order to actively explore. Attunement. In all the observations she did, what Ainsworth was looking for was a parent's ability to tune in to their child, which led to the two of them acting as a unit, rather than for the parent to try to follow a list of to-do items of good parenting. Attachment research has shown that even the most securely attached relationships are attuned only 50% of the time, which I think is incredibly good news and is very consistent with what Donald Winnicott, another British psychoanalyst, called good enough mothering, good enough parenting. It doesn't need to be anywhere close to perfect, and I would add or argue that it's precisely because it isn't perfect that it's good. Behavior modification, meanwhile, which was pretty prevalent at the same time that this was starting, they warned that picking up a crying child led to spoiling the baby. Attachment theory said the exact opposite. How much better off everyone is when parents attune to a baby's request for soothing, which actually leads to less crying. Proximity seeking describes the baby's returning to the secure base. As Bowlby wrote, most people think of fear as running away from something, but there is another side to it. We run to someone, usually a person. Mutual delight. Ainsworth defined delight as a high degree of pleasure and enjoyment. And this author says, delight doesn't follow any rules. Felt security. It's not just enough to be close in a manner that can be observed by outsiders. We have to feel close and secure. Earned security. This was a new phrase to me until reading the book, and that's been defined as the process by which individuals with insecure attachment histories rise above their trauma and develop secure relationship patterns. Other terms and phrases used in the field are responsiveness, co-regulation, and balance between attachment and autonomy. What Bowlby was saying, according to this author, is that love is more than a feeling. It's part of a whole behavioral system. And I'll say a little bit more about my clinical work soon, but here I wanted to add what Carl Rogers called unconditional positive regard, which I've always thought was his preferred professional way of saying unconditional love. So I am a graduate of in 1985 at the University of Winnipeg, where I first became friends with Jan Schmidt. And I don't remember learning anything about attachment theory at University of Winnipeg, as much as I value that experience. When I began graduate school later that year at the Institute of Child Development in the University of Minnesota, I was obviously very ready to learn about attachment theory, and I was thrilled to become a research assistant on what's called the Mother-Child Project, a major study in the field of attachment. This was a study, or is a study, that followed the same subjects for many consecutive years, 40 as described in this book, and maybe still going on, I didn't check that. The study began when the child was minus 3 months old and the mother was in her third trimester of pregnancy. And it was not a cross-sectional study like many psychology studies are, where the sample is intended to replicate the wider society. This was usually called an at-risk or poverty sample, where the study subjects had a much higher rate of poverty than the population as a whole. And I'm quite sure that the Mother-Child Project, which I was a little part of, was the first and maybe the only study ever that has conducted two generations of strange situation procedures. When the 12 and 18 month old infants came the first years, and then they came back 20 or more years later with their own infants and were the parent, and then did the strange situation as the parent. So there is video of the same individual, first as baby, and then 20 or more years later as parent, that I am completely jealous of the research assistants who got to observe those videos and code those videos. How fabulous that must be. So I want to share a little bit about findings from the Mother-Child Project. I remember very well my advisor in his office had shelves that had articles, the published articles from the Mother-Child Project on them, a lot of articles, but there was one that was my absolute favorite by far. In this study, maybe related to the fact that it was a poverty sample, there were a number of mothers who reported having been abused as children. And then the Mother-Child Project identified those children who were being abused. And so some graduate student had a very bright idea to compare these two groups, those mothers who had been abused and who continued the abuse of their own children, and those mothers who had been abused and did no longer abuse their children. And two main differences were found. Those who didn't continue the abuse were much more likely to have a stable, significant relationship with another person, either a romantic partner or a psychotherapist. Also, the mothers who did not continue the abuse were far more specific and blunt when they would describe their own histories. The abusing mothers were much more vague in describing their own history, perhaps showing a desire to minimize their own history of abuse, and maybe even to prefer not to hold their abuser to account. And in case it isn't obvious, this is one way in which I see a potential parallel between those findings and River East. Even though River East is obviously a community and not an individual person, you strike me as being eager to provide support for those who have been hurt and distressed. And it sure seems to be a safe place that encourages honest awareness and expressions of people's experiences, including their painful past experiences. So going from grad school, where I learned about attachment theory from an expert, I began work as a clinical psychologist. And you might ask, how was my work influenced by attachment theory? And I think that's a really good question. When I first started working, my very first clinical work while I was still in grad school doing coursework, I did play therapy with four-year-olds. And I still remember, that's a long time ago, I still remember sitting on the floor with a four-year-old and maybe being asked a question. And I would have a sudden burst of insight or intuition as to how to respond to the infant. And later when I was in my office alone, I would want to get to the source. Where did that come from? Where did that burst of insight come from? And the way I remember it, it never came from any of my fabulous child development classes. It was a moment that I experienced in my own psychotherapy as a client from my therapist who will have said something similar. And for what it's worth, I don't think anybody should be allowed to sit in the therapist's chair without already having sat in the client's chair. Also, when a client would want to pay me a compliment as a therapist, I always corrected them to say that my understanding of effective psychotherapy is that the compliment really belongs to both client and therapist. Any healing or improvement that occurs is a credit to the relationship and the give and the take between client and therapist. Obviously, the therapist needs to be boundaried and always focused on the client's best interests, but it's both. That's how it works. Something I think a very academic advisor, who is married to a wonderful clinician, would be pleased to hear me say here this morning. I also want to share a story that's my absolute favorite of play therapy, especially when somebody is skeptical. How can play therapy be therapeutic? You're just playing with a kid. Well, I hope this story gives you a really strong evidence otherwise. The client was a boy, probably about 9, and I'll call him Rob. I've long forgotten his name. He was the oldest child of a single mother who was very lovely, but who seemed to lean on him a little bit too much and expect a little too much responsibility for him to take a little too much responsibility for his younger siblings. In the privacy of my office, he loved playing with Legos, and he seemed a little apologetic about it, as though he thought maybe he was a little bit too old to enjoy playing with Legos. So for the first few sessions, I would sit at the table with him where he was constructing his Lego play and comment and observe and ask questions. And he loved building airports. He would always, almost always build an airport out of Legos and then a little airplane. And then he became the pilot of that airplane. And after a few sessions, I felt ready to construct, to join in a little bit more, and I constructed an air traffic tower, control tower. And pretty soon we were having a banter between pilot with his little plane, Lego plane, and the air traffic controller. Cleared for takeoff on runway 4, coming in for a landing. Proceed to gate 22. And then one session after the plane had landed and taxi to the gate, the pilot said to the air traffic controller, "Thanks for your support." I am almost certain that Rob could never have told Gerald, his therapist, that same sentence. But in the context of play therapy, he, in such an unabashed and enthusiastic way, he could say it. And that's turned out to be the most beautiful and memorable single moment that I remember in my work, in my play therapy with kids. Another quick sidebar is one from outside attachment theory. It comes from the woman who founded, if you like, Ambiguous Loss. And the book I would highly recommend is her book called The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in the Time of Pandemic and Change. And of this, there are two copies in the Winnipeg Public Library. And something I've never done before or since, as soon as I finished reading this kind of slender book, I bought 3 more copies and gave them to my mother and 2 siblings. That's how incredibly impressed and much I love this book. Pauline Boss, B-O-S-S. And I think her emphasis on honestly acknowledging and being aware of the pain of loss is very compatible with attachment theory. For the Douglas folks and others that are new, or no, this is for Douglas folks, that may be the loss of your Douglas experience. And for River East, maybe that's the anticipated loss of the changes that might occur in River East as you know and love it. And one last book I want to mention that I got just on Friday and I'm looking forward to reading. There are 0 copies of this in the library, in Winnipeg Public Library. And once I finish reading, very selfishly after preparing all this and being reacquainted with attachment theory in a whole new and fabulous way, I'm very eager to read it. It's called Attachment in Religion and Spirituality, A Wider View. And Mary Main, who devised the adult attachment interview, writes about this book, an intriguing and remarkable book, drawing on both his own and many others' interview-based and observational studies. The author, a Swedish gentleman, finds that our attachments to God can be characterized similarly to our attachments to intimate friends, partners, and parents, as secure, avoidant, ambivalent, or disorganized. Bowlby and Ainsworth would have found great value in this work, writes Mary Main, expert in the field. And finally, I want to end with 2 examples that I think I have observed, or I know I've observed them. I think they qualify as good attachment principles here at River East. And then I'm eager to hear your thoughts, responses, questions. One comes, the first of two comes from Agnes Hubert. I recently received an email from her in which she said, "As for you knowing less than 10 people, just keep coming to River East and the number will increase, I promise." I was so struck and still am by her use of the phrase, "I promise." She didn't say, "Keep coming to River East and I hope you will get to know more people. I think you will get to know more people." She promised it. And I dare say this very experience might be the beginning of the fulfillment of that exact promise. Thank you, Agnes. And Henry, her brother, who I've helped me get ready. Thank you for this. And the other example are, maybe there are two examples kind of in one, but they both relate to what you call Table Sunday. On most Sunday mornings in the 2 years that I've been back, I'm in Steinbeck with our 93-year-old mother, when she likes to watch the Steinbeck MB service online because she hears it better. So I've only been at River East in these last 2 years about four times that I can count. And I already have a pretty complicated history with your Table Sunday. I'll describe last week's Table Sunday in a moment, but I almost attended the one previous to that a few weeks ago. I saw the reference to Table Sunday in the website, River East website, and I wondered, what could that be? The only thing I could think of was a communion table, but that didn't really seem to make sense to me. So on that Table Sunday several weeks ago, I got as far as the foyer when somebody explained that the gathering was downstairs, not here in the sanctuary. My response to that was a burst of what I'll call introvertive anxiety. And so I left. At about 3 minutes to 10 o'clock, and just outside, just by the steps there, going to my car parked on McLeod, I passed two or three individuals, four maybe, coming in at the bottom of the steps. I thought it was completely obvious that I was leaving the building. And one gentleman wearing glasses, I believe, who might be in the room, I don't know, was very warm in his greeting with me. And there was no look of judgment or confusion or consternation on his part. And I was very pleasantly delighted. And regarding this past Sunday, I was so eager to experience my first communion at River East, but noticed that once again, it was on a Table Sunday. But this time I managed it differently, and you might describe my behavior as proximity seeking to my secure base of Jan Schmidt pancreas. And this is what I texted to her or emailed to her. "Can you please explain Table Sunday at River East this Sunday? Does that mean that worshipers are seated at tables in the basement? In case it isn't obvious, I don't think I'm ready to sit alone at a table. I wouldn't be anxious about sitting alone in the sanctuary, and have already done so. But alone at a table seems to cause just a little too much anxiety." To which she replied, quote, "I would be delighted to sit with you." Without knowing it, I'm sure, she even used a magic attachment word, delight. So it's pretty clear what my opinion is. In the little time that I've left over, I'm very eager to hear what yours might be and also hear any questions or comments that you might have. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thanks for listening to the River East Church Podcast, the Jesus community for the world. We are an Anabaptist church pursuing wisdom, prophecy, and compassion here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can find us online at rivereastchurch.ca. We hope you join us for next time, and until then, may grace and peace be with you.